Welcome to Whitley on Wine with your host, nationally syndicated wine columnist Robert Whitley.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow. Talk to me nice, talk to me nice, you've got to wine me. Don't try to fool me, be Julie. Either amuse me or lose me. I'm getting hungry. Peel me a grape.
Welcome once again to Whitley on Wine. And this week we are making a trip to Oregon. Oregon's known for Pinot Noir, more known lately for Pinot Gris, and some other grape varieties that are coming in there. And joining me by telephone is Harry Peterson Nedry of Chehalem Winery in the Willamette Valley. How are you, Harry?
I'm doing well, Robert. And you? You probably have more sun than we've got.
Oh, I wish. I think we're having some Portland weather here.
We've
got these squalls coming in off the ocean, and so it's rainy, and then it's sunny, and then it's rainy, and then it's sunny. It's very un-San Diego-like. It's kind of like, this is a good time to go to Oregon, because we have some simpatico going on between the two locations.
We actually do have blue sky and sunshine.
Make me jealous. So we're getting it intermittently, and we're having a big golf tournament here this weekend, the Buick Open at Torrey Pines, and they played in some wet conditions yesterday, and the wind is blowing off the ocean, and this is our winter, so this is about as bad as it gets. But anyway, we're here to talk about Oregon, and you are very involved with the Vintners Association there, and you do some work, on behalf of Oregon, but you also have your own winery, Chehalem Wines. And before we get into the real broad Oregon context, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about your introduction to wine. I know you're a transplant from North Carolina.
Yes, many years ago, 30-some years ago.
Why did you go to Oregon? Why didn't you go to the Napa Valley?
My initial intent that plopped me into the Northwest didn't really have anything to do with wine. I'm a chemist, but and that's helped, definitely, in the wine field.
Yeah.
But I was here to do other things in the Northwest, and I happened to be here at a time when the industry was just beginning, and it grabbed me by the neck and said, you're going to get into this too.
And you got involved in the 80s, right?
I began my first vineyard in 1980, began looking at it 78, 79 for it, and found it in 80. And from there on, it was kind of the vertical integration of get grapes, get a winery,
sure,
get marketing.
You know, Oregon has become quite renowned for its Pinot Noir. And you've also made some tremendous inroads with Pinot Gris. And I personally believe the Chardonnays have gotten much better in, I'd say the last 4, 5, 6 years, something like that.
There's some exquisite white varieties.
Yeah, but what I'm wondering is, when you first got involved, when the industry was just sort of in the beginning stages of awareness, did everyone really have this idea that Pinot Noir was going to be your calling card?
I think Pinot Noir has always been the main focus for people in the Willamette Valley. I don't think that has changed from the beginning. If anything, it's become hyper-focused now, to where people who are beginning see it possible to start in an industry like this, either coming from another region or being undercapitalized and not being able to do wine in California.
Is that some of the fallout from the movie Sideways?
I think Sideways is what in another modern phenomenon, a book called Tipping Point, or The Tipping Factor, whatever it was called. I think Sideways was a tipping point for what had been a lot of hard work by people from Oregon and California to say that the New World makes great Pinot Noir too, and there had been 30 plus years worth of work going into that, and I think that one movie allowed the average consumer to pronounce Pinot Noir and say, oh, maybe I should try this.
Yeah.
I think that was the only... I don't think it made the variety at all. I think it's made in the vineyard still.
Sure, absolutely. Let's go back to your beginning, though. You were in another industry. You didn't come from, you know, wine tradition, family type thing, background. What drew you to wine? What was the catalyst for you?
I am definitely a techie, and I grew up as a career in high-tech manufacturing of one sort or another. So as a chemist, I got into technical fields and mm-hmm. understood processes. And what attracted me to wine was the fact that wine can be both hedonistic and subjective, and on the other side, very responsive to highly technical interpretation and objectivity. So it has the ability to go to both the right and left brain of people. And
oh, sure.
I'm one of these. I mean, maybe it's schizophrenic. I'm both right brain, left brain, and I go back and forth between it so much that when I came from the university, I went to the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. I came out with a degree in chemistry, but at the same time, I was so enamored of the more hedonistic, appreciative side of things mm-hmm. and humanities that I got a degree in English at the same time. So
yeah.
I flopped back and forth between those, and I think that's one of the things that attracted me to wine, is that you can appreciate it on the hedonistic level, but also you can not only make one great vintage if you're a good romantic and happen to stumble across things, but if you're technically competent person, you can guarantee that those vintages are year after year, so you can aim for some consistency.
You know, you raise an interesting point, and it's funny because I was just thinking about this the other day, the subjectivity of whether we like a wine or not, and we like a wine and somebody else doesn't like the wine, and you can make a technically perfect wine, and you can also make a wine that has some little flaws that many of us would find interesting characteristics and actually like in a wine. Now, so how can it be that we could have something that's technically flawed but tastes very, very good, and we like that?
I think complexity and interest are definitely what appeals to us about wines. Complexity, mm-hmm. intensity, interest, things that taste good, smell good, and even flaws up to a certain concentration.
Certain
provide
tolerance
intrigue.
Level. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it's a little bit like smelling something in the distance and saying, ooh, that's kind of interesting. What is that? And then get up a little bit closer and it's a dead skunk. You definitely need to be a purist. You need to be technically sound. You don't have to have flaws to have intrigue. That's where the vineyard siting and the expertise of the winemaker come in. Those same sort of interesting elements can be provided by what we look to wine for: representation of terroir, of the place that it's grown, of the hand of the winemaker.
You know, I oversee three big wine competitions, and I obviously select the judging panels, and I'd like to have a winemaker on each judging panel, but then also people from the industry who represent another point of view. And the reason I tell people is winemakers are, when they're judging a wine, they're looking for what's wrong with the wine, and the rest of us are looking for what we like about the wine.
I think that's many times true. Winemakers, I think, need to slap themselves every now and then.
Yeah.
And say, come
reality.
On, get real.
Reality check.
Yeah.
Harry, we're going to take a break now, but we'll be back with Whitley on Wine and Harry Peterson Nedry of Jehalem Wines in Oregon following these messages.
And I mean, don't try to peel me a grape.
And now, back to Whitley on Wine.
Slowly.
With your host, nationally syndicated wine columnist, Robert Whitley.
I'm back, And I'm chatting with Harry Peterson Nedry of Chehalem Wines in Oregon. And one program note before we continue with Harry. Coming up in the second half hour, we will visit with Sarah Belk King, the cooking babe, the In the Kitchen columnist for Wine Review Online. And Sally will be talking about Oregon cheeses. So, Harry, I'm hoping you can hang in maybe for a few minutes into the second half hour and maybe share some of your knowledge about these Oregon cheeses.
I would love to do that. Sarah and I have tasted together actually last year, so I appreciate her insights and things.
Yeah. Now, I have to apologize to you. I didn't realize you were a North Carolina Tar Heel. And, you know, I'm a Maryland Terrapin. And
and you're going to bring up last week's ball game.
Yeah, when Maryland beat the number one Tar Heels. At Smith Center, how did that happen?
Well, I think in the ACC, any one team can beat any other team, no matter how vaunted.
Yeah, and we get pretty avid about our basketball down what they call Tobacco Road. So, and you know, I have family in just outside the Charlotte area, so I have some affinity for North Carolina as well. So yeah. When they play, I have mixed emotions, although I'm really a Terrapin at heart. So anyway, more about Oregon wine. So, you know, especially in the Willamette Valley, it was Pinot Noir, which really got the initial acclaim for Oregon wine. Now we're seeing all of these, as you put it, in the first half or first segment, as you put it, the interesting white wines. Which varietals are you talking about?
I'd like to preface it by saying that we do have a tendency to make things as simple as possible to understand, especially if you throw them 3,000 miles away to the East Coast or somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And to a very rightful degree, Oregon is known for Pinot Noir, and that is very appropriate. There's been a lot of work put into it. It's probably the second best place on the planet to grow Pinot Noir after Burgundy.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Russian River Valley.
I could say that at some other time.
Okay, I'm pulling your leg.
But when we start really looking at the state of Oregon, one has to admit that the Willamette Valley is a very powerful wine-growing region. It's a cool climate. It's very appropriate for Pinot Noir. The climate itself and the soils make it fantastic for Pinot. It also makes it fantastic for white wines because cool climates basically give the opportunity for finesseful, elegant wines, and that isn't just Pinot Noir.
Mm-hmm.
It is Pinot Gris, which is our highest yielding, highest volume white wine. But it also makes for fantastic cool climate Chardonnays. And I say cool climate Chardonnays to reference, say, the clonal materials that we've, over the last 15 years or so, finally had in Oregon from Burgundy that make our Chardonnays, as you alluded to in the first segment, exceptionally intriguing. And it also, cool climates are obvious in areas like Germany and Alsace and Austria as being great territories for Riesling. And even though when I began in 1980, there was something like 23%, I think, of what Oregon produced was Riesling, it was the Riesling that we all learned to cut our teeth on as far as wine was concerned back in those days, but was pretty vapid and insipid and went by the wayside. However, I have actually made a rather careless prediction, and that is that given another 10 to 15 years, we're going to see Riesling once again not as it is now 4% of what we produce in Oregon. I think it's going to be the top white variety that we grow. Because
really? Now, you think it will overtake Pinot Gris and Chardonnay?
You bet.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow,
and,
that's
and,
a pretty
and
bold
we're
statement.
Doing great jobs with those other varieties, but mm-hmm. I just think Riesling, if I had one white variety to leave on the face of the planet, it would be Riesling.
So what's the difference? Is it a specific clone of Riesling that is being planted in Oregon that is going to make this transformation?
No. Unlike Chardonnay, which I could say you're right. It's a set of clones that are appropriate to the climate here that makes Chardonnay exemplary here. But with Riesling, the clones are less important, and it's the climate.
Mm-hmm.
It's the climate, totally, no matter what the clones are. I actually have a mother block in one of my vineyards that has all of the clones that are available in the U.S., and we don't really see much difference between clones.
Now, you must be happy, then, about the fact that Riesling in the United States, which had really been sort of in the doldrums for a couple of decades now, is starting to make a comeback.
It is. I saw one statistic that it was the fastest-growing varietal during some period of time during 2007,
mm-hmm.
Finishing up the year. We actually have some industry work going on Riesling to get the word out even better now that people are receptive. Last year there was a conference of basically winemakers, wine writers, and people from all over the world who grew Riesling called the Riesling Rendezvous. And the people at Chateau St. Michel in Washington.
They
helped to put this on. And one of the offshoots of that was that a huge table of us decided that we needed an international organization to educate people on fantastic Rieslings and why they should be interested, and also to take some of the things that are hard to understand about Riesling, like how can you have a wine that does not have any sugar, taste sweet, or how can you have a wine that's got gobs of sugar but has high acid, not taste dry,
mm-hmm.
and it's simplify all, that for the public?
All about the balance,
right?
Yeah, I think to me the difficulty from a consumer standpoint of Riesling is knowing just by looking at the bottle whether it's a dry Riesling, an off-dry Riesling, slightly sweeter Riesling, or a dessert Riesling. Now, dessert Rieslings typically come in half bottles. So that's the tip-off when you see Riesling in a demi that it's going to be a dessert wine. But I think with the difference between dry and off-dry, it's much more challenging. And, some people like both, some people don't. And sometimes a dry Riesling is much more appropriate to the dish you're serving than the off-dry is, and sometimes the off-dry is much more appropriate.
Agree completely. And the key to it is the consumer knowing what to expect when they open the bottle of wine. And that is one of the things that this international group that we actually are having our second meeting next week in Sacramento for members from across the world to get together and make some decisions, some additional decisions. And that's part of what we're focusing on, is how to communicate very crisply and easily what the consumer should mm-hmm. see on the inside of the bottle.
Now, I know some people will put on the label dry Riesling, and that's fine. I wish there was some other way where you didn't have to basically alter the name Riesling to something else. I wish there was some way you could indicate that it's dry, it's off-dry, or, mm-hmm. or whatnot. In fact, checking on wines at the Monterey Wine Competition, which is my current thing because it's coming up, the deadline's coming up very soon. I called Eaton Hill Winery earlier this week, and they had two Rieslings that they had entered, and the same vintage, and they both said Riesling on the label, and boy, I had a hard time figuring out which one was the dry one and which one was the off-dry. And so I called the winery and kicked it around with them a little bit. And I don't know what the ultimate solution is. But I do think that that's one thing that the people who produce Riesling need to keep in mind.
Yes, I agree totally. There needs to be nomenclature, and there needs to be some other hint on the bottle as to what they're getting. Because just by if people even put the percent sugar on the bottle, that would in itself, even though it would be a good guide, it would still be misleading, as I said before. There are some dry Rieslings mm-hmm. that are 2.5% sugar or 2% sugar that have high enough acid to where they taste bone dry. And there are others that are 0.7% and are soft enough and don't really have huge acid
sure.
that taste utterly sweet.
You know, I've had some of the Washington Rieslings that were, 4%, and you think, oh, man, that's really sweet. But the acid was high enough that the wine, even though it didn't really strike you as a dry wine, the wine hit you as a well-balanced wine.
And very appropriate for the meal.
Exactly. And so you're right. I think it could be misleading if you just put the sugar levels, because that doesn't tell that doesn't tell you anything about the balance of the wine. What I always think is it should be, what did the winemaker, what did the producer of this wine intend for? Mm-hmm. Is this meant to be slightly sweeter, to be served with spicy dishes, or is it meant to be drier? And, you know, it should go in the category in terms of descriptor that the winemaker intended to produce it, rather than just looking at the numbers and saying, oh, because of the numbers, it should be this or it should be that, because it doesn't always work out that way.
I agree. Wines like Riesling, though, are amazing in a cool climate, and that's the mm-hmm. one thing that I think will continue to amaze people from the Willamette Valley, the cool climate region here in Oregon. One thing I might mention for people who see Oregon on a label is that all wines made in Oregon aren't from the Willamette Valley, and mm-hmm. there's such a diverse range of climates here that there's some amazing Merlots and Syrahs grown in the Walla Walla Valley, which is half in Oregon, half in Washington.
Half in Washington, sure.
There's some great Merlots and Viogniers and Syrahs and things like that grown down in the southern part of the state outside of the Willamette Valley.
And isn't part of the Columbia Valley in Oregon?
You bet.
Okay, so it straddles,
half of it,
yeah.
The Columbia cuts is basically the border between the two states.
Sure. Sure. Now, you, we only have a couple of minutes here before sure. we go into the break, but you mentioned new clones or cool climate clones for your Chardonnay. I really do believe, and I'm curious to see if you agree with me, that Chardonnay from Oregon, which I used to think was just really fairly ordinary.
And it was.
Is
you have
now,
a very good palate.
Now very complex. Beautiful wines, beautiful Chardonnays are coming out of Oregon.
I think they're gorgeous. I just wrote the technical winemaker description for our latest release, 2005 Reserve Chardonnay, and all of the descriptors are fantastic. I mean, you're talking white Burgundies and mm-hmm. Grand Cru Chablis when you're talking the types of things that we were tasting in some of these wines, and we're in the middle of the pack, or we definitely are not the only one making great Chardonnays. There's a whole bunch of us who are committed to these what are called Dijon clones.
Mm-hmm.
They came over from Burgundy, and they were selected at the University of Dijon for replants in Burgundy. And what we had been lacking for so long, and the reason the wines were lackluster when the ones that you were talking about, is because they were the wrong clone for our climate. They were warmer climate clones. What we needed were the cooler climate like Burgundy has, and it's made all the difference in the world.
You know, I think we only have about a minute left, and if we get cut off by the music coming up.
Okay.
In fact, I'm told, what, Lou, one more minute? One more minute?
Please.
Yeah. So, anyway, I want to talk about vintage variation in mm-hmm. Oregon, because I think it's much more pronounced in Oregon than it is in California. And tell me if I'm wrong. But we'll discuss this when we come back on the other side of the break, and we'll have Sally join us. So Whitley on Wine will continue with Harry Peterson Nedry of Chehalem Wines following these messages.
Nice, you've got to wine me.